Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in African American History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Amanda Joyce Hall, one of the hosts of the channel. Today, we're excited to talk to Hillary Moore and James Tracy about their new book, No Fascist USA, the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee and Lessons for Today's Social Movements. I found this to be an important book about fearless organizers and activists who created an anti-racist, anti-imperial social movement that fought against the normalization of white supremacy during the 1970s and the 1980s. Hillary and James, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Hi.
Great to be here.
Yeah.
It's wonderful to have you. Hillary, I wonder if we could begin the interview by you telling us a little bit about yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks. Well, I was born and raised in California, and I grew up in the Eastern Sierras, and grew up in an area that was pretty low and working class, middle class, and pretty rural and white. And that shaped a lot of my upbringing and my worldview. And it wasn't until I started to become involved in climate justice movements in the Bay Area in my early 20s that I started to realize what the context meant of where I came from. And being around very, very strong, beautiful, brilliant climate justice organizers from communities of color, I started to realize what was at stake in a different kind of way when there are white supremacists, whether they're out or not, you know, organizing in communities and or just having influence of ideas. So I lived in the Bay Area for 15 years and did work with Catalyst Project. And now I work with Showing Up for Racial Justice, even though I live in Berlin, Germany. And a lot of my work has centered around just white people being able to organize and come together around dignity and having that dignity being really centralized in anti-racism and building broad movements that can affect change. And James has been both like a mentor and a friend of mine for quite a long time. And it was around Trump's presidency, his like lead up to his campaign, where white supremacists were becoming more visible and more organized, and in that work, also people trying to figure out how to confront that and take action against that. And I went to a counter rally in Sacramento, California, where I also saw a number of anti-racist protesters get stabbed by the white supremacists that were having their rally, that were evoking Trump's narratives and kind of using that moment to build a broader movement. And it really rocked me. And so I started to just talk with all the people I have a lot of respect for around how to make sense of doing long-term anti-racist community organizing. And then also this new political moment of accelerated and very obvious white supremacy in a way that hasn't been around, at least in this kind of way, in my lifetime. So trying to pull together these threads of like anti-racism and anti-imperialism and anti-fascism. And then what does that look like and how accessible can that be? Like, so those are some of the questions that had me talking with James, and then through those conversations, we just decided a book was necessary.
Mm. And James, how did, can you tell us about a bit about yourself and how you came to this?
Yeah. My name's James Tracy. I currently teach at City College of San Francisco in the Labor and Community Studies Department. Ever since I was very young, I've been involved with organizing, mostly housing and local politics, organizing in the Bay Area. And I first started to find out about the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee in 1989, when they sold me a paper. They came to Vallejo, California. I was about 19 at the time, and they were out doing a counter-mobilization against the Nazi skinheads that were trying to organize a white power concert that we talk a little bit about in the book. They were doing outreach and making the case to myself and our neighbors that we shouldn't join the Nazi skinheads, which was not a hard sell for most of us, given growing up in one of the most racially diverse cities in California, if not the United States. It was definitely a formative experience watching all of that go down in my hometown. Many years ago, I was already politicized in many ways, but this really deepened my understanding of white supremacy and racism in the United States at a very, very young age. And the experience has stuck with me throughout the years. And so when Hillary approached me about doing a book together and possibly studying the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee, of course, I jumped at the chance.
Okay, wonderful. Well, let's get into that. So No Fascist USA is highlights the work of the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee. So let's establish some of the information about kind of what are the origins of the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee, who is in its membership, and what type of political climate did they grow out of?
Yeah. The John Brown Anti-Klan Committee has a number of threads that kind of merged and formed this organization within these very particular contexts. I think one of the most important pieces, and we begin the book in this way, is talking about what it was like in the late 70s for revolutionaries, radicals, people invested in social change, people who were willing to have big hopes and dare to shape society back, and how this political moment had taken a very deep hit. And COINTELPRO, the repressive programs put forth by the federal government to investigate and surveil and also execute different leaders in different liberation movements, had a very deep impact in both movements here in the States, but also then what that ripple effect meant because people were organizing internationally at that time. And so that was kind of the moment. We kind of describe it as like on the ropes, like radicals readjusting to a new political terrain. Mm-hmm. And in this moment, that kind of also opened up the space for new white supremacist organizing. We talk about in the book how the Klan was trying to remake its image and how it was putting forth the idea that for white rights and have building organizations around white rights, because white people were having their rights infringed if they're not able to get housing, if they're not able to get jobs, if they're not able to get all these things, kind of evoking the idea that people of color, or they were explicitly evoking the idea that people of color and Black people were somehow taking away their rights if they didn't have them, which was absolutely the opposite was happening. Most programs meant to build up the poor and working class or people of color communities lift everybody, lift all the boats, lift public education, roads access, like all these different programs lift everybody. But explicitly racist organizations like the Klan were using that moment to basically entrench the idea of reverse racism. So this was the beginning, the bubbling of those kinds of ways of thinking about race that really shifted after the 60s. And then also a consequence of COINTELPRO meant that a lot of leaders were incarcerated. If they weren't underground, if they weren't executed by the government, then they were incarcerated. Mm-hmm. And so we talk about it in the book too, how as specifically white people, especially coming out of SDS and like in similar organizations, white people who were in on anti-racist struggles were now quickly in on political prisoner support work. So the mm-hmm. terrain in that way really shifted quickly. And in that context, there were organizers in New York and people who were committed to anti-imperialism who received a letter from a Black Panther in a New York State prison who said that the Klan had power and positions within the prison system, within the prison that they were being held in, mm-hmm. and basically was like, this has been public for quite some time, and our demands are not being heard. And actually, the risk of us being in here, not only in the prison system, but having Klan is like the educator, the teacher in the prison system, or guards in the system. Like the harassment and the danger was actually increasing, even though it was publicly known that the Klan was working in the prison. And so basically, when legal channels shut down, people who were incarcerated put out a call asking for there to be an outside pressure, an outside amplifier to mm-hmm. take action and, you know, kind of pose the contradictions or pose the moral imperative of like, this is not the world we want to live in, and also apply pressure and make demands that reflect the demands of the people that are incarcerated. And, you know, depending on the organization that might be listening to that, they may or may not reflect the exact demands of the folks on the inside. It might be watered down or translated in a different way. So when the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee was forming, it was with people who were working in an organization called the Inside Outside Coalition, which was a mix of formerly incarcerated people and college students working at campuses to kind of get the word out about what, you know, the early aspects of the prison industrial complex were looking like, and kind of supporting those on the inside. And so it was through that organization, as well as a number of anti-imperialist organizers in New York City, and kind of the exchange between them. And they had established the John Brown Book Club, and they were studying and also adjusting in the political moment. And when that letter came out of the person, his name is Hodari, when he wrote that letter, it was like a bit of a spark or a catalyst. It was a very clear call of like, dominant society is not listening to us, not responding and not acknowledging what these demands are, and not taking action for the amount of risk that these leaders who are now incarcerated, yet another layer of danger that they're in. And so the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee formed in 1997. Really with the idea of acting as a buffer between Black leaders and people of color leaders in liberation movements, in anti-colonial mm-hmm. struggles, acting as a buffer. If the state was coming down, or if white supremacists were coming down exceptionally hard on that leadership, then they wanted a strategic position of like a group of really committed white people who knew why they would want to take action and kind of get in the way of the incoming. And James can talk more a bit about the social movement side of like the lineage that comes from John Brown. or John Brown comes out of.
Yeah, well, the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee initially, as Hillary pointed out, were people from the 1960s and 1970s New Left that were looking for ways to apply their politics in a completely new, new but not unanticipated context. So we see people from Students for Democratic Society, people who had cut their teeth volunteering in the South, in the anti-war movements, whether underground, forming different collectives like the Midnight Special Collective, and figuring out ways to continue their politics. When we say that the context was different, well, the right, the far right at the time had also organized their own movements, and they weren't called reactionaries for no reason, right? Most of the things that we associate with the new right aren't necessarily the flashy, violent, skinheads, white Aryan resistance types. Also during this time, they built their movements through public policy, the tax revolts, the very beginning shots at the welfare rights wars, and of course, funding for public schools. Those were all initiatives that the right used to build their power up. It then culminated in the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980, and then always depended on this section of their movement, the shock troops, the organizations that were willing to take it to the streets. So we really see these two movements in this time parallel: the growth and the victory of the new right, plus the outgrowth of the new left, trying to apply their politics in this new era.
Right. And it seems that the book does a good job of tracing. It's illuminating. It's terrible, but it's illuminating how the Klan infiltrates local and federal tiers of government, and how grassroots activists are responding to this. So you write, while increasingly marketing itself, and this is the Klan, as a nonviolent cultural institution, it was still a paramilitary vigilante group that was allowed to operate within the shadow of state institutions. And then the committee emerges kind of as a response to the way that the Klan and the state become intertwined in what you call the political economy of armed white supremacy that began with settler colonialism and the war on Native Americans and continued to impose itself through the enslavement of Africans, slave patrols, and convict leasing system and Jim Crow, and deeply shaped the imperialist nature of U.S. foreign policy, and then even onwards to shaping the carceral state or mass incarceration of this period. So it seems that the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee is really this radical a movement against this longer history of racial capitalism in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And there's one quote, I think maybe towards the end of chapter one or maybe in chapter two, when one of the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee members talks about Reagan and mm-hmm. the inauguration of Reagan, and also just what a game changer Reagan really was mm-hmm. in shifting the terrain right, and of course setting things up for Trump these years later. But the quote is something along the lines of, we hated Ronald Reagan, but depending on how long your view of history is, he wasn't a surprise either. Mm. And I think that what you just kind of pulled out there resonates with, I think Laura Whitehorn said that. And the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee really saw that different formations of white supremacy usually come in response to especially Black political power. So like after Reconstruction era is when the Klan like really emerged and served its function to reclaim white power, literally back into the hands of white people after Reconstruction. And we saw, we can place the backlash of the 70s and into the 80s of the right-wing shift of Reagan. You could place that in relationship to the winds, the global winds, and the big shift in power where different colonized peoples rejected or overthrew or gained a sense of a kind of political autonomy back from their colonizers. And so there's like a big shift in the 60s into the 60s with anti-colonial movements worldwide setting the world on fire. And then you can see, again, a retaliation, a backlash of white power, of people who explicitly talk about a white nation. There's that aspect of it. But then there's all these other gradations and other aspects of even niceties. I think in chapter 1, 2, it also talks about Trella Laughlin, one of the Austin organizers. And she talks about how her parents were part of the White Citizens Council. And she grew up in Jackson, Mississippi, right? You know, in high school during time of segregation and like her school, she graduated 1 year before segregation was deemed illegal, even though it persisted in lots of different kinds of ways. But how she talks about it was the nicer way to be racist. Like they would give money to the Klan, or they would say like, you know, that they would never take the action in which they could be so obviously attributed to Klan imagery or Klan persona. But there's also much nicer ways to be racist or to support a white supremacist agenda. And so the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee really connected the different kinds of white supremacy, the different forms and the different functions, not saying that they are the same, but saying that there is an agenda or there is a direction that is pointing, and the police play a kind of role within that pointing of policing and controlling Black and Brown communities. The U.S. empire globally plays a kind of role in securing resources and dominating global dynamics. And the Klan plays a kind of role domestically, also harassing, controlling, applying pressure to Black and Brown communities. So they may not be one coherent, coordinated body, but there are different aspects that are pointing to a logic of white supremacy. And so that was at the core of the organization. That was really the fundamental organizing principle of the organization. And I think that is also what sets the organization apart from many other anti-racist organizers or organizations at the time, especially during the anti-Klan movement that was in the 80s, where I think a lot of people got into motion because the Klan was on the rise. And so it was very anti-Klan specific. And while the organization, of course, has anti-Klan in the name, it really brought in these other also international pieces about how white supremacy works and functions, especially in U.S. empire.
Right. And in terms of the philosophy, where I saw what I recognized was one of the philosophies of the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee is kind of encapsulated in something that you wrote here. It's they believe that white people had the responsibility to assume the risks that Black people experienced every day. And kind of like emerging from that thought, I'm wondering if you could explain like what the members of the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee's relationship to whiteness was and how it shaped how they organized, how they built alliances with Black and Brown led organizations and just how it affected their activism in general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'll say a couple things and then pass it to James. Also at this time in the late 70s and 80s, of course, white supremacy was being talked about, but not in any kind of way or scale or common language that it is today. And so I think if we kind of time travel back to this moment where this organization, the purpose is really to support movements for self-determination and to challenge white supremacy in all of its forms. Like, that was what the organization was built around. And it's a pretty hard line. Like, it's quite bold. And then it comes to really interesting conclusions. Like, interesting conclusions are drawn from that. And my impression of the organization is that they saw themselves and their whiteness, but especially within the terrain of political opportunity, as a strategic partner. Like, it was not about, oh no, we're white people, so how do we help ourselves not feel so shitty for being white people? And what can we do to support, or no, what can we do to like give charity, or what can we do to make up for the fact that we're white? It was always continually assessed, like, what are the movements for self-determination doing? And how does our relationship to those movements and supporting, you know, their wins, their exploration of what solutions could be, their vision for another world, like, how can we consistently keep tuning our relationship to these movements? So in some way, they often saw the vision or the solution to ending white supremacy is like full support of movements fighting for self-determination, that was fundamentally rooted in another idea and another vision of another world. I'll pause there.
Well, the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee chose John Brown as a symbol, you know, as a message to the rest of the left and other white folks. They were the ones that were going to be serious about assuming the risks, and that others should as well. We're all very familiar with the idea of white skin privilege now. It's not that controversial. Every college professor talks about it. It's a very common part of our dialogue. But back then, it was a little bit more controversial as far as how it fit into the to the overall political economy and conditions in the United States. One thing, when you ask about how they related to whiteness, that I think is really interesting, is that they related it both on a structural and a personal level. So the personal level is encapsulated in that we have to assume the same risks that our comrades of color have been assuming for many centuries. But then the structural part, it's not just about invisible backpacks for them. The structural part is that they're looking at the ways that white supremacy has been sewn into capitalism from the very beginning, sewn into all of our institutions and expectations of our society. So they're drawing from a lot of different intellectual traditions, certainly. Du Bois being one, the foundational work of Ted Allen, thinking through about how white skin privilege is a strategy used by rich folks. Are definitely looking at the settler colonial theories put forward by Jay Sakai, and embracing quite a few of those that took a very pessimistic assessment of class, one that I don't share 100%, but I can certainly understand, where it came from. That's the core of the matter. It's not simply a assuage your guilt model of dealing with white supremacy. It's not simply about being nice to other people. I'll certainly, that was part of it being, being a good racial citizen, but it was about challenging the very structures of society that reproduced and privileged white supremacy.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right. And I thought that the committee's commitment to teaching other white Americans what it actually means to be anti-racist was a part of kind of what you were just saying, is that it's to do more than, you know, pacify any kind of guilt or anything like that. It is to do more than believe in equality, or even believe in certain principles. It's to enact a particular vision of the world. And yeah, I just thought that was one of the most important kind of like efforts that the committee undertook. Mm-hmm. So I want to talk a little bit about the campaigns and the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee's campaigns and the work that they did in in actually creating a national movement and keeping that national movement on the same page or keeping it unified. So you mentioned the Stop the Killer Cops campaign, Blue by Day, White by Night. I'm wondering if you could speak to the local and national registers of the committee and the ways that that was kind of forged, because I think we look around, you know, the United States today, we see that there's a lot of good work happening at local levels, but how does it get to the level of becoming a national movement? And I think that the way that you narrate the story of the committee shows kind of how it can do that organically, or how local efforts can become something of significance nationally.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, like we were saying, the organization really came out of a call, and they were a response. And from that point on, then it was just a continual renegotiation of what is most effective or what could be most useful in supporting movements for self-determination. And if that's the compass, right, if that's the main question that you kind of read your campaigns on, or make adjustments here, or create new chapters by, that's a really different set of strategic questions than a whole other set of questions, which could be, you know, where are we going to get the most people? Or where are we going to get, you know, the most tweets, or, you know, most visibility? So it was, again, like the emergence of different chapters was also in response to different conditions on the ground, and it looked really different on the ground. Not one chapter was exactly like another. Mm-hmm. And it started, of course, like on the East Coast, and then it emerged also in New England area. There was a couple of chapters that came into being that were shorter lived, but came into being because there was another incarcerated leader who needed support and needed a bit of a network around them to help them get through the lived experience of being incarcerated, imprisoned. Mm-hmm. Or there's other chapters that really emerged like in Chicago or Austin or San Francisco. There was LA. Each of these chapters emerged because there was already different organizations, different movements, like the Republic of New Africa or the Black Liberation Army, or different like Brown Berets, like in action. So different organizations that were fighting for self-determination and in work that were also asking for strategic support, also asking for public presence of white folks that were quite committed to something similar. And so sometimes, yeah, it looked really different in different ways. In the Austin chapter, the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee really started forming coalitions with the Black Citizen Task Force and the Brown Berets, creating a strong, broad-based coalition that was supporting like voting rights and registration and people getting jobs. So doing the support work necessary for these like community-based organizations on the ground. And then also they were a kind of leadership on the ground as the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee was going toe-to-toe with different Klan efforts, like Klan Watch. They were on the border watch. The Klan was getting highly militarized on the border, kind of taking up or filling in the role of border patrols. And so then they were, the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee was organizing against the proliferation of that organizing. So it looked really different in different ways. And then I think in creating like a national response or a national movement, there was different aspects of coordination. So John Brown members were both coordinating with local organizations where they were working with on the ground. And then there was also relationships with just broader movements that were happening at the time, like I said, with the Republic of New Africa and the Black Liberation Army. And at different moments, those folks were also kind of providing like guidance or vision around what was needed. So in 1983, when like after the Greensboro Massacre, and it was getting very obvious that the Klan and different Nazi formations were starting to make unusual alliances, when Reagan was really carving out more space for white supremacist organizing and using hushed tones to do it, but also like not acknowledging the impact of the Greensboro Massacre. A lot had shifted in the first 3 years of the 80s, and a number of people were kind of pointing to the fact that what we need now is a more unified vision. And so the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee, in fact, was more parsed out. And then in the 80s, in response to those folks and the people that they were working with, decided to strengthen the organization more nationally. And so started to come together and share stories across different contexts and start to like kind of take on a more national presence, even though still it was only 12 chapters throughout the arc of its life. I think it was 13 years of the organization, but they started to move or try to have a more of a national presence in that way.
Mm-hmm. I would just really, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. No, go ahead.
I would just really organize. Underline the idea that the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee were just one part of a movement. You know, look, the National Anti-Klan Network, ARA, Anti-Racist Action, and many more. You know, people, you know, even teachers' unions were coming up with curriculum to teach anti-racism in their classrooms, and that in itself was a risk. So when we talk about the national scope, just thinking about, there's so much stuff going on, both formally in organizations and networks like the ones we've both mentioned, but also spontaneously. I remember people running to Kinko's Copies just to make flyers, say, "Hey, white supremacist man is playing down the street in Berkeley. you know, on Friday, let's all go, you know, let's all go and shut them down. Lots, you know, there was lots of different types of movement going on, not just the anti-Klan committee.
Right. And with that, I'm wondering if you could tell us more about some of the tactics that you describe in the book that the committee kind of like invents. One of the ones where I had to pause and laugh was the graffiti sandwiches, the gravel sandwiches. And so, yeah, I wonder if you could just share about some of the tactics, but also some of the risks that the activists took on in going and confronting the Klan and the American Nazi Party. And the cops.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, like you mentioned earlier, that at some points, the John Brand Anti-Klan Committee was pointing out the fact that the Klan had infiltrated some of these institutions, so like police departments and we're working there, or prison systems and working there, military working there. And then there's also, of course, the piece around like those institutions sharing a logic with the Klan. But so there would be particular, you know, demonstrations, there would be rallies where white supremacist groups were getting together. And Trella Laughlin was talking about how in Austin, sometimes, you could go, or like at a demo in Houston, right? You would go, and when you got there, you would see the Klan and the cops chatting it up, and you could tell that they were friends and knew each other for a really long time. If not, they were friends in other kinds of contexts. So there was kind of a knowing that they were different, but also a deep suspicion of like the inner workings of how those formations work together. And so with different tactics, I would say that the John Brand Anti-Klan Committee was rather bold and sometimes naive in their exploration of what worked. One thing I appreciate about the organization and throughout the arc of the organization, it's one of the things I think is really smart and beautiful. And one of the most important lessons is, how do you adapt over time when conditions change and shift? How do you maintain a principle or a North Star, but you might shift form, adjust campaigns, and even tactics along the way? And you've mentioned the gravel sandwiches, and I think that that was pretty accurate and a reflection of the organization in the early days, like in your face, gonna give you a gravel sandwich for lunch. And I don't care if you're a cop or a Klan, this is what you're gonna get. And that's a kind of confrontation that might be effective or useful in some times. And then over time, especially when in the early 80s and in the Austin chapter, they started to play around with, okay, so if not everybody is going to do the gravel sandwich approach or go directly to the houses of the Klan members or out them in their homes or their neighborhoods or their towns, what are other kinds of ways to get more people, more white people, into a relationship with these liberation movements that we care about so much? And so they started to form coalitions, and they started to think about different ways for different people to get involved in that. And I think from the early to mid 80s on, I think in the Chicago chapter especially, and then also in the San Francisco chapter, we're a lot more creative in terms of like, okay, now what is our strategic role within a coalition? So what is our strategic role in movements for self-determination is a kind of strategic relationship, but then that can also be scaled down and to think of like, okay, if we are known in this kind of way, if we hold this kind of politic or have this kind of quality of presence, how can that be used within a relationship to the NAACP, right? If the NAACP doesn't have, like, cannot afford to put the reputation on the line to go to the house of the police officer who has been being accused of responsible for the murder of four Black men in Richmond, California, they can't do that. But the John Brand Anti-Klan Committee can. And there's different ways that you can play that you can leverage a moment in that way. And I think the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee was quite skilled in that way. And I know James loves the Chicago chapter, so I'm going to let him talk about the graffiti campaign.
I think both the graffiti and the punk rock stuff showed a very specific and special moment in the evolution of the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee. So in Chicago, especially in Uptown, but many other neighborhoods, there was a spate of racial graffiti, which should not be surprising to anybody who knows Chicago, because it is one of the hotbeds, always has been a hotbed for racist far-right or organizations. Most people are familiar with it through the famous Blues Brothers scene. But during this time, the racist graffiti was going all over the place. The John Brown Anti-Klan Committee could have just chosen to gone and painted it over themselves and taken pictures of themselves doing this brave act and, you know, getting into tussles with the skinheads. But no, they built a broad coalition of church groups, a few arts groups and labor groups, to really, really speak out against racist graffiti and then go cover it up together, collectively, really building, using this opportunity to build a movement, to build participation. And it also meant working with people that did not share your exact politics, your exact version of anti-imperialism or whatnot, and negotiating those spaces, because that's the trick in coalition, is how do you build as broad as possible and still maintain your principles as an organization. I think they did really well. And what was so important about this intervention is that anybody who grew up in the 80s recognizes how the dialogue in graffiti was always deployed in a racist way to just reinforce whatever the right's messages were around morality and race and the degradations of cities, telling stories about the cities, moving the conversation away from the impacts of neoliberalism during this time and moving it towards that the problem is your local tagger, right? And all the racist codes that come with that. So they really turned it on their, turned that conversation on its ear, whether they intended to go that far or not. I think they did. And on McGromskin, I believe, you know, culture, you know, dealing with the impacts of culture is incredibly important, but also for the ability to reach hearts and minds isn't something that's only done in the streets. Many people, by involving themselves in the punk rock scene, coming up with anti-racist themed shows, opportunities to show music and have speakers, you're talking about ways to reach out to really angry white kids and come up with wild propositions of what to do with that anger and who to be angry at. I think it's one of the most special contributions of the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee. And then you see this being expressed, expressed in the famous Oprah Winfrey episode when she had members of White Aryan Resistance on, and the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee, Howie Emmert was in the audience at the time, John Brown member, bringing together anti-racist skinheads in the audience to be able to be a counterpoint to that. So you don't get those type of results. You don't move angry white people away from being angry at black people without doing the work and coming up with creative ways of reaching folks with new ideas.
Right. And I'm so glad that you brought that up, because I definitely don't think we can talk about the 1980s without talking about culture as being an integral terrain for political struggle. But I also think that the 1980s is kind of what you just brought up about Oprah, that media plays an important role here, and TV airtime. So were there ways that the committee was able to get media coverage outside of the Oprah episode? Were there other ways that they leveraged media?
Absolutely. Yeah. I'll go back to Austin again. This was also the moment where public access television was a tool for communities to use, and it was far more accessible, of course, than what we have access to today. But Trella Laughlin was one of the people that created a show called Let the People Speak. And that was an effort to amplify the campaigns of the Black Citizens Task Force and the Brown Berets. So she would interview different organizers in those groups every week and just have a chance for the Austin community and, of course, beyond to hear, like, what's the work they're doing and why. And so when you see the Black Citizens Task Force, you know, in your neighborhood or making demands at City Hall, it gave just their campaigns a far greater reach. And then also she was a big part of establishing the shows of those organizations so that they had their own organization. But she used the platform of television also as a strategic counterpoint to the fact that the Klan and David Duke and other white supremacists were absolutely leveraging media, radio stations, and public access television at that time. And what was really important too was the newspaper that the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee did throughout the arc of the whole organization. So there's actually quite a lot of newspapers that you can find at Freedom Archives. .org, and it's just this beautiful, rich movement archive, and the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee is one organization that is documented there. But you can watch the arc and the arguments and also the editorial skills of the organization grow and shift over time. And they talk about the fact that the Klan at the time was doing this multiple strategies where they were trying to remake their public image. You know, Duke was running for Senate in California while at the same time as supporting the Klan groups on the border. And so there was, like, both on the ground and underground, as well as above ground and electoral strategies happening at the same time. And the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee was writing about those things, putting out articles, you know, getting into debates and deliberation publicly and trying to spark a kind of deliberation that maybe we don't get to see so much today.
So what are some of the legacies of the John Brown Committee? What happened to the committee? Where did the activists end up?
We talk about it in the book, is that there was no clear moment, no group meeting decision where the organization decided to end. Different chapters completed in their own kind of way and kind of unceremoniously. But another important lesson of the organization is just how it was that they carried those principles, those original principles, into other movements, into other organizations, into founding or supporting ACT UP and different ACT UP chapters also in Chicago and New Orleans. And people who are organizing for and putting pressure on pharmaceutical companies and government to get access and resources for people dying of AIDS. And those same political principles continued of who is being impacted and why is that happening? And then the ability to take bold risk and take action, right? And letting that be what is most important and letting those visions, like, really come out in that process. And then a number of the founders of the organization too went on to found prison support organizations and are still in them today. And I think not only were a number of people in the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee, like the Constellation, some folks did end up going to prison for their political work. And so then they had also this experience of being incarcerated, along with the fact that the organization had always, from the start, had been a part of supporting people who are imprisoned. And so that anti-racism work, that anti-colonial work, kind of then extended further into AIDS work and ACT UP work, but also in the early stages of the prison industrial complex, they were still organizing around how AIDS even impacted those who were incarcerated or who had access to legal support or who had access to different kinds of knowledge. And I think James wants to pick up on that thread too.
The women who really threw themselves into the anti-prison work, Nancy Kershen, Pam Fadem, Linda Evans, I mean, they had something to grapple with, which is the understanding, you know, of what a blurry line it is between being a social prisoner and being a political prisoner in the United States. And a lot of their intellectual work, a lot of their activism, I think, is one of the links between the 1970s prisoner rights movement and what eventually became known as abolitionism. Not too many people mm-hmm. were using the word prison abolition at the time, even though we first see it being used as early as 1973, but it wasn't in, you know, kind of mm-hmm. common parlance at the time. And so as they were supporting people who were there for political activities, they were also becoming much more aware of the growing prison industrial complex and doing a lot of foundational work that we still see being carried on today by organizations like Critical Resistance and many dozens of others. And I was very, very touched. Maybe hopefully a historian listening to this out there will pick up on this. We'll give this idea to you for free. The new left prisoners of war and political prisoners that went on to do groundbreaking popular education and mutual aid work around AIDS is something that I think scholars will be looking at for, you know, hopefully for many years, because it's things, approaches, and tactics that have been incorporated into mainstream harm reduction, mainstream AIDS approach. But at the time, it was literally information that was snuck into the prison and snuck mm-hmm. back out to outside supporters. The fight against white supremacy, racism, and everything happens in some loud ways, and it happens in some soft clandestine ways, like I just mentioned.
Right, and I think I'll kind of add to perhaps what you just said about our understanding of the left. So I guess a question, maybe perhaps both of you can chime in. But what does this knowledge of the John Brown Committee add to our understanding of the left in the last 2 to 3 decades of the 20th century?
It's a fabulous question.
What's your take?
I think the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee is a worthy organization to study for like the full range of what they were doing. And we were excited to write about this organization because there's also many aspects to the organization that, you know, we get the vantage of hindsight. And we get to make our assessments today based on our experience today. And so we can look back and be like, what were they thinking? Or what was that about? But what is really important as activists and organizers, but also as writers with history and memories of these folks who have dedicated their lives to these movements, is the ability to share information across generations and then to keep going. I think that was one of the most beautiful things about the organization and the people who opened their hearts and shared their stories with us about this project, you know, a number of decades ago, where people put their bodies on the line and constantly renegotiated what would be most effective right now. And they were anti-racist and anti-imperialist. And that was at the center of the organization. It wasn't an afterthought. It wasn't a box to check off. It wasn't a thing just to do so that you can keep doing what you're doing. It was the thing that they were organizing around. And I think the fact that the organization lasted so long and through really important big changes in the U.S. political system, in the political terrain, and the kinds of questions that they kept asking themselves. And then the fact that most of them are still in motion in different kinds of ways today. There's something really important and invaluable about that of like, what does it mean and how do you put these politics into motion and have it change the rest of your life and like have your life organize around a political commitment, mm-hmm. not in any kind of like idealistic, venerated way, but like, no, these are actual principles that you organize your life around.
Right.
Well, maybe the, maybe book publishers and academics and filmmakers might put a temporary moratorium on future works on the 60s and look at the 70s and 80s that the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee were a part of, just one important part of, and look at the ways that the left survived when everybody, you know, everybody thought it was on the ropes and gone. Left activity ranging from from militancy all the way to electoral work and all points in between, the left persisted. So if there's a ray of optimism in this book, I think that's one of them.
Right. I agree. So let's move to the 21st century. I love that the book is framed as having lessons for today's movements. So can you distill what some of the lessons are that we should draw from the story of the committee for confronting all of the issues that we have today, from the carceral state, widespread inequality, just anti-Black, anti-queer violence all around us, climate change, so many things. Yeah, what lessons should we draw from this?
Well, we talked about a number of them. I think in general, it can be kind of summed up of what is the practice of solidarity. And I think that in the time of COVID right now, we are in the same question, although it takes on a different kind of context of what is mutual interest? What is mutual aid? How do we actually work together in a way that lifts each other up, but also acknowledges that certain people just experience a disproportionate impact in a racialized capitalist our society, and especially in the US in a kind of way. And so like that question gets to be an evolving question, and it can be a question of creativity. It can be a question that gets to open our minds and open our visions out. I think that the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee is also an important example, especially for folks in social movements or anybody who's studying state repression or the ways in which movements ebb and flow and the different components to that. And that has to do with grand juries and when people are willing to take larger, bigger risks to confront the state or to push back on corporations. What is the crackdown that happens? And then how do people come together? And I think the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee is a really good example of kind of navigating the waters first from like self-righteousness or like a really strong political line that pushes people away. And then the fine-tuned skills that you need to still have a political line, but that draws people closer. And I think that they are a really important study in knowing how movements have done that previously. So today that we don't need to recreate wheels.
Well, I hope that people would read this book and come away with the same burning sense of solidarity that the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee had towards their work and take action no matter whether they had self-interest in it or not. But if that's not going to work for folks, I will just remind people that this history shows us that, as the great writer James Baldwin said, if they come for you in the morning, they'll be back for me at night. By allowing these movements to grow, both on the streets and in the electoral arena, that sinks all boats eventually. The public policy that Reagan was able to push through certainly harmed Black and Brown people first, but then kept on moving through union busting, through the slashing of the social safety net, through the decimation of educational opportunities, and has harmed the working and middle and poor white folks as well. And so I hope people take that and then apply take action in any way that makes sense in their own communities.
Right. I like that. Yeah, we should forge solidarities. We should build coalitions. We should take action. Those are, yes, three important lessons you can learn.
Good old-fashioned family values.
Well, Hillary and James, we've taken up a lot of your time. But before we go, I want to ask about what projects you're working on now.
In a couple of weeks, on May 12th, I have another book coming out. It's a book for climate activists around the world, but it's also geared towards what's happening in Europe, where far right and racist groups are really leveraging the climate crisis to forward their agenda. And the booklet kind of breaks down why it is that nature and climate can swing both left and right. And it kind of outlines where left movements fall into the holes that really right and racist narratives get to grow. And it looks at six different countries, and then it poses some important questions for climate activists around what does it mean to be fighting climate change in a society that is growingly authoritarian and has fascist movements here. And if we don't take into account those formations, then we're really missing a big political piece in what is politically possible. So that book is called Burning Earth, Changing Europe, How the Racist Right Exploits the Climate Crisis and What We Can Do About It.
Okay. Congratulations. That sounds like a very important book. I look forward to checking it out.
Cool.
Yeah, I can hardly wait for that book. What are you working on? Well, I'm taking advantage of having so much time at home to start research on two projects. I'm taking a bit of a break from awesome white people doing things in the movement themed, and I'm looking at in-home support service workers, reproductive labor, and unionization. And also I'm starting to write about all the different rock and rollers that went into the prisons, not just Johnny Cash, but Loretta Lynn and many other musicians like the Cramps that went into institutions and performed. So just using this time to expand my horizons and do a lot of writing.
That sounds like two great projects as well. I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it, and I think that we learned a lot and covered a lot, actually. So thanks for being here, and take care.
Thank you so much. You.